This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Maya Rudolph, recently returned to NBC's Saturday Night Live to host the show on which she had appeared as a regular cast member for 7 years. On SNL, she was known for her portrayals of Oprah, Beyoncé, and Whitney Houston, and also as the co-host of Bronx Beat with Amy Poehler. Last year, she co-starred in the hit film Bridesmaids. She's currently co-starring in the NBC sitcom Up All Night as a daytime talk show host. And she's in the new movie Friends with Kids. Terry spoke with Maya Rudolph earlier this week. Friends with Kids is about two best friends, played by Adam Scott and Jennifer Westfeldt, who also directed the film. They both want to have children, but neither has found a suitable mate. So they decide to have a child together and co-parent while they continue to pursue romance with others. They've soured on the idea of marriage, watching what's become of their married friends with children. Maya Rudolph plays one of those friends. In this scene, Rudolph is with her husband, played by Chris O'Dowd. She's kind of offended that their friends have decided to have a baby together while remaining just friends.
Why are you so upset?
Why? Because it's an affront to us.
To us? Like, specifically to us?
To all normal people who struggle and make sacrifices and make commitments to make a relationship work. Yes, it's insulting to us specifically and in general.
Wow, okay. Okay, Judge Judy.
Wait, you don't think it's insulting to our way of life?
Our way of...
What?
We're not Mormons or old-timey people. We don't exactly have a way of life,
You baby. Know what I mean.
It's a brave new world, honey. There are test tube babies and surrogate babies and John and Kate plus eight. I don't think that two friends having a kid together because it might be her last chance is the worst thing that I ever heard.
Maya Rudolph, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here. So you play the mother of two in Friends with Kids. There was a time, I think, when actresses dreaded reaching the age when they were cast in the mother roles because those roles were unlikely to either be interesting or to be central to the movie. Think that's changing?
I do. I mean, I've never worked more. I never really worked before. It's funny. I think since I've become a mother, I've worked quite a bit more, but I also, you know, I've noticed a lot of my peers have been writing, and it definitely feels like it's in the air. It's in the ether. I think I've always said yes to projects, whether I'm pregnant or not, and I've been pregnant 3 times within the last 6 years. So sometimes my characters have to become pregnant in order for me to work, but I just, I think I like working, so I just keep going to work.
Were you pregnant when you made Away We Go, in which the character's pregnant?
No.
See, what a waste.
That would have been very helpful.
You should have coordinated that better.
It was probably for the best. I was in a much better mood.
You and Kristen Wiig are both in Friends with Kids, and of course you both were in Bridesmaids. Starting with, like, Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and Kristen Wiig and you and your writing partner from Saturday Night Live, Emily Spivey, who writes mm-hmm. for your sitcom Up All Night, mm-hmm. it seems like, you know, now only in the recent past have the women from Saturday Night Live kind of emerged to do projects together, writing roles where women were really central, as opposed to singular women, you know, leaving Saturday Night Live and hoping they could find roles.
Yeah, a lot of us come from improv theater backgrounds and sketch comedy groups, which is actually where I met Emily Spivey. I met her at the Groundlings in Los Angeles, 15 years ago. And we used to perform together in the Sunday Company, which is the same for Amy and Tina at Second City in Chicago. And actually, Kristen and I did not cross paths at the Groundlings, but she came out of there as well. And for me and my group there, there seems to be this, I don't know, we all seem to share the same sensibilities in terms of writing for each other, with each other, and for each other. I like comedy as a group sport. I mean, there isn't any comedian I know that doesn't love to kill, as they say, or crush. You know, you want to be funny, but I think that, especially with the stuff I did at Saturday Night Live, I found that when the sketch as a whole is funny, you know, you put the best people in it, and I'm used to working with people, great people, and when you know their voices, you have so much fun writing for their voices. And we all sort of come from that school. And I personally think it's a more enjoyable way to play.
Do you think that there's a kind of story or a kind of character that you and women writers that you've been working with have come up with that men might not have thought of?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I was surprised at the way people perceived the idea of Bridesmaids and how they thought it was meant to be a women's movie. And then a lot of men, especially men on the street, would stop me and say, you know, I didn't think I was going to like it, but my wife took me, but it was funny. And I remember thinking, I've never set out to write a funny movie or be funny in a movie as a woman. I am a woman. I don't really have a choice in the matter. My goal is just to be funny. So I think one of the magical ingredients about Bridesmaids and why I think people responded to it is that we just found it funny and we felt like we spoke the way that we really speak, and we tried to find the things that we thought were the funniest.
Now, Bridesmaids was both praised and criticized for showing that women could do a gross-out scene. And this is a scene where everyone's in their bridal outfits at the wedding, you know, at the bridal store, and they all simultaneously start to feel the symptoms of the food poisoning that they've all gotten, and they all simultaneously lose control and run to the restroom, and you're trying on your bridal gown, and then you're overcome. The restroom's taken, so you have to, like, run across the street hoping to find an available restroom someplace else, and you're overcome in the middle of the street. So a lot of people think, like, yay, they proved women can do a gross-out scene. Did you, like, set out to prove that, or did you just think, like, well, that'll be funny? Like, how did that scene come about? Like, what was the genesis of that scene?
The scene was not originally in the film, and I think it was born out of the idea that both Judd and Paul felt like Kristen's character, Annie, really needed to screw up even further. Originally, we went to the bridal shop, and she had forgotten to make an appointment and couldn't afford the dresses that Helen wanted to get. And a lot of those things are still there, but they thought, well, what could she do that could really just show that she just has no handle on this whatsoever? And it was, oh, take everyone somewhere terrible for lunch and so that they all get food poisoning. And when I first read it, my character was written as, I was running across the street and I jumped as though I'd been shot by a bullet. And I just thought, God, that sounds terrible. I don't want to do that.
Too broad? Too broad?
Nothing's ever too broad for me. It just sounded really like it was so far from reality. And I think what we all silently came up with, and we've talked about it since, which is no one really discussed it, but what every single woman found in playing that scene is we were trying to make it seem like we were okay and we had everything under control. And that was never really discussed, and that's what I find really fascinating about that scene and why I think it plays kind of beautifully, is that we all sort of improvised trying to keep it together as best we possibly could.
So Bridesmaids is about a friendship between two women or three women. It's kind of like a friendship triangle. And I want to play a friendship scene between you and Kristen Wiig. And in this scene, Lillian, your character, has flipped out and gone missing from your own wedding, and no one can find you. So your friends call Annie, the Kristen Wiig character, and since she's already flipped out, you kind of kicked her out of your wedding. And so your friends have called Kristen Wiig's character to see if she knows where you might be.
Right.
So she goes to your old apartment and finds you there under the covers. And then you're telling her about how you've been thinking about how much things are about to change now that you're getting married.
I'm sorry I kicked you out of my wedding. It's my fault.
No, it's my fault. I think I'm the one with the mental problems.
Yeah. Wasn't it my turn to be crazy?
Yes.
The bride's supposed to be crazy,
technically,
right? You kind of stole all the crazy.
I out-crazied you. Everything's going to be okay.
Yeah? How do you know that? I left the rehearsal dinner last night. I told Dougie I had to go get Q-tips. And all of a sudden, I realized I was driving here. I came here. I realize this is the last time I'm going to be here in this apartment. With that couch and this bed and take a bath in my bathtub, because you know how much I love my bathtub.
It's a good tub. I slept in there on my 30th birthday, remember?
Everything's gonna change. I mean, I'm not gonna get to live 5 minutes away from you. And it makes me so sad.
Well, don't be. Don't be sad, because things are gonna change, but they'll be better. You know? You're gonna take this huge, great, beautiful step, and Dougie loves you more than anything, and so do I.
But what about you? What's gonna happen to you?
It's my guest Maya Rudolph and Kristen Wiig in a scene from Bridesmaids. And Maya Rudolph is co-starring in a new film called Friends with Kids. So were you able to draw on your actual friendship with Kristen Wiig in doing scenes together?
For sure, yeah. We super bonded on this movie, but I started working with her at Saturday Night Live. I was actually on maternity leave when she started. And when I came back, I was lucky enough to get to work with her and be thrown into what I refer to sometimes as the comedy army together. You're sort of bonded for life when you work with people there. You cry together, you eat together, you laugh together. And I don't know why I said cry first. That's not what people think about when they think about working at Saturday Night Live. But it's a really intense schedule. It's a 6.5-day week, and they're late hours, and you're writing, and she's just one of those people that I clicked with right away, that felt like an old friend. And that scene that we just heard is actually, it's really nice to hear, because it's a combination of the script and Judd. All I remember him saying was, make sure you get in my line, you stole all my crazy, you know. but I hear the two of us really talking to each other the way that we really would. And I really feel proud of that.
So you brought up the cry together, that Saturday Night Live was a place where you could bond together and cry together. Can you remember an instance where you were reduced to tears?
Oh, well, I don't mean just about the show. I mean, when you work at Saturday Night Live, you're there all the time. I mean, for me, before I had children, everything about my life was devoted to Saturday Night Live. And you're also, you know, you're writing as well as performing, and you're there sometimes on Tuesday nights until, you know, I usually stay till 6 or 8 in the morning. And
whoa,
you're exhausted, you're loopy, you've eaten McDonald's at 4 in the morning, which is terrible for anyone. And you've had 3 shows in a row, and you haven't done any of your laundry, and you have no food in the fridge. And it's really difficult to be there for anyone else in your life when you're doing the show, because of the hours that it demands. And so I say cry together because, you know, especially the women, you start to help take care of each other. And I love that we have that history, and I love that we were able to implement it in these characters, because I think without it, it just becomes a story about people getting ready for a wedding. And I don't think that was ever the intention of this movie at all.
Has your life changed a lot since Bridesmaids?
It's changed a little bit. Yeah. I mean, people don't think my name is Maya Fey or Amy Rudolph or Tina Rudolph. They think I'm the lady that pooped in the street. So that's always nice.
Yeah. They're
it's an advance in life.
It was great to see you recently hosting Saturday Night Live, you know, returning there as a host.
You.
And you seem genuinely moved to be back there in that position. So just tell us a little bit what it felt like, and if you ever thought you would make it to that position of being back as a host.
Well, that place is very special to me. It really, truly was my childhood dream. And it was tough sometimes, too, and it can be frustrating when you don't get your pieces on, or you know, things get cut at the last minute, or you flubbed a line. And I mean, I still remember the lines I flubbed, and when you do them live.
Such
and,
as? Yeah.
I remember in the national anthem, there was a line that always made Keenan laugh when I was rehearsing it. And I used to say, and I'd always say it for him because it tickled him. And I would say, instead of singing Gave Proof to the Night, I would say, Give a Little Bit of Proof. And I got really nutty about it, and I overshot it, and I just said, Gave a Little Proof. And just the fact that I didn't say bit of still haunts me to this day. It's really stupid.
Why is that?
I said it at dress. I don't know. I think I wanted it to be perfect, which doesn't really exist. But when something is live, you know, I knew what I wanted it to sound like, and I felt like I had a really strong piece, and I had a lot of, I put a lot of pressure on myself.
And what was the context for singing that?
I was supposed to be singing the national anthem at the World Series, and my character just oversang it. The idea for it came from watching one of those clips of people auditioning for American Idol, and they had a medley of people singing the wrong lyrics to Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And I remember there was a girl that sang, Buy me some E-Nuts and Apple Jacks. And that kind of gave me the idea.
I want to play another one of your sketches, a recent one from when you returned to host the show. And in this sketch, you're Beyonce, and so it's Beyonce and Jay-Z, and you've just had your first child, Blue Ivy, and some of their celebrity friends are arriving to see the new child. And at this point, LL Cool J has just walked in, and you're telling him about the birth.
It was perfect, LL. We were in the hospital, just me, my husband Jay, and Kanye. First, my water broke, and I was like, ah. And then I went into labor, and I was like, ay! And then the baby came out, and I was like, oh! And I asked my doctor, did I have a boy? And he said, no, you had a single lady.
That's Maya Rudolph on Saturday Night Live. We've heard you sing comedically, but I'm sure you can sing for real. And your mother, the late Minnie Riperton, was a very popular singer. She was best known for her 1975 number one hit, Lovin' You, in which she sang a phrase that was perhaps like the highest notes ever on a pop record. What was it like for you when... I don't even know if you were old enough to understand the level of your mother's fame.
No, probably not, because in 75 I was 3 years old, but what my parents were doing seemed normal because that's what they were doing when I was born. You know, my mom was music, so, you know, music poured out of my mother, and that I'm sure I heard it, you know, before I even got here, you know, when I was in her belly, and music sounds and feels very normal to me. And my dad wrote all those songs with my mom. And so my dad was always playing his acoustic guitar, his like Brazilian kind of chord changes. That's my dad's style. He's really adorable. And they were on the road a lot. My brother is 4 years old and me, my brother Mark, we used to go with them. I think when we were very little, simply because my mom did not want to be away from us. And I think my mom went out on the road really quickly after I was born and then immediately said to my dad, bring the kids, we're all going because I can't be away from you guys. And so my dad ended up playing guitar with her on the road as well. And I don't totally remember that, but I do remember, you know, losing a tooth, I think in Reno or something, and getting like a, you know, some sort of chip from the casino or something.
So let's hear your mother's hit, Lovin' You, and this is from 1975. This is Maya Rudolph's late mother, Minnie Riperton.
Lovin' you is easy 'cause you're beautiful. Making love with you is all I wanna do. Loving you is more than just it's the dream come true. And everything that I do is out of love and you.
That's Minnie Riperton, recorded in 1975, a song that reached number one on the charts. Minnie Riperton is Maya Rudolph's late mother. Maya Rudolph's father co-wrote the song, and Stevie Wonder produced it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very, very end of that track, she sings your name. Just as it's fading.
Yeah.
Did that mean anything to you when you were old enough to realize that she was singing your name, that you were somehow included in her most famous song?
I always knew the song as having my name in it, and then as she went on to perform it, you know, in various places, she would add my brother's name or my brother's nickname. His family nickname is Ringo, so sometimes she says Ringo. And I learned the story much more recently in my life. My dad told me that I knew I was a very loud baby, but you know, I think I cried a lot. I think I needed to be picked up a lot, is my impression of it, or that I just screamed basically. But my parents were always sort of playing that song. I think it was more originally a lullaby that they were sort of working on and playing, and I seemed to really perk up and love it. And I've seen tons of pictures of me as a baby that my mom obviously took, where you just sort of see the back of my dad's hand holding the guitar and then me with my hands up by my face, like shrieking in delight. You know, I think I loved it. And I think before it had words and they were working on the song, I think that was my lullaby sort of. So I think that's probably why she kept the name in there, which is really sweet.
Maya Rudolph, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. It was a pleasure.
Maya Rudolph speaking with Terry Gross. Rudolph co-stars in the new movie Friends with Kids, which has just opened in theaters. Also out this week, Bruce Springsteen's new album, Wrecking Ball. Springsteen told Rolling Stone it's, quote, as direct a record as I ever made, unquote. It's also one of his most stylistically diverse, including elements of gospel and hip-hop, as well as rock and the blues. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I'm a homesteader in these meadowlands, where mosquitoes grow big as airplanes. Here where the blood is spilled, the arena's filled, giants play games. So raise up your glasses, let me hear your voices come. Cause tonight all the dead are here, suffering on. Bring on your wrecking ball.
It's not difficult to guess what the overarching theme might be on an album Bruce Springsteen characterizes as being as direct as any he's made. The title song is one he wrote a few years ago to commemorate the demolition of Giant Stadium in New Jersey. It was written from the point of view of the stadium. But in its new context, the wrecking ball is a symbol of the implacable forces that have wrecked the economy for millions of people. Government policy, banks, and politicians are among those wielding the wrecking ball that, to Springsteen's way of thinking, is putting dents in, if not shattering, many people's souls.
I'll mow your lawn. Clean the leaves out your drain. I'm in your roof to keep out the rain. I'll take the work that God provides. I'm a jack of all trades. Honey, we'll be all right.
That's Jack of All Trades, in which Springsteen sings in the character of a kind of universal laborer, eager for work yet bitter. There's a verse about how, quote, the banker man grows fat, working man grows thin. It's all happened before and it'll happen again. But the song takes a rather surprising turn at the end. Replacing resignation is rebellion, with the narrator saying that if he had a gun, he'd shoot those who exploit him. The song is something of a purposeful mess. The point of view shifts constantly, from that of a man begging for a job, to one addressing a lover with the assurance, honey, we'll be all right, back to that guy whose despair has moved him to violence. It's all underscored by a guitar line from Rage Against the Machine's Tom Morello. Ultimately, the song is an unruly creation that works, because of the music, which is rich with ripe melancholy, and a subtly relentless pace that moves you toward that violence before you realize what's being sung. And indeed, it's the music you have to heed before the lyrics throughout Wrecking Ball. Death to My Hometown, a kind of bleak sequel to Springsteen's Born in the USA song My Hometown, is an Irish jig that moves with jaunty aggressiveness. The album's first single, We Take Care of Our Own, is a full-bore blast of sound that could easily be the kickoff song on any given night of the tour Springsteen and his E Street Band are commencing with the release of this album. But Springsteen works with co-producer Ron Aniello to create something less monolithic than an E Street Band record. It's a Springsteen album made with a wide variety of musicians and technology. Tape loops and samples are deployed to make sonic collages. On Rocky Ground, Springsteen has even written a rap verse.
You use your muscle and your mind and you pray your best. That your best is good enough, the Lord will do the rest. You raise your children and you teach them to walk straight and sure. You pray that hard times come no more. You try to sleep, you toss and turn, the bottom's dropping out. Where you once had faith, now there's only doubt. You pray for guidance, only silence, now meet your prayers. The morning breaks, you will wake.
When I first got the finished CD of this album, I looked quickly at the credits for Rocky Ground and thought it read, featured vocal by Michael Moore. Turns out it was gospel singer Michelle Moore on that song, but there's so much socio-political content on Wrecking Ball, it wouldn't have surprised me at all if the boss had cajoled the agitprop filmmaker into howling a verse about, say, the present state of labor unions. Still, I think one of the ways to miss the most significant achievements of Wrecking Ball is to concentrate on the lyrics and not appreciate what Springsteen is doing with the music here. It's a marvelously diverse creation, drawing upon and uniting so many American periods and styles of popular music that it creates a very effective tension. The lyrics may speak of despair, but the music testifies to a bottomless ingenuity, invention, and yes, exhilaration.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Bruce Springsteen's new album, Wrecking Ball. Coming up, William Shatner talks about performing his new one-man show at age 80 and about being one of pop culture's most iconic, if occasionally mocked, personalities.
If you could fight any celebrity, who would you fight?
Alive or dead?
Doesn't matter. Who'd be tough?
Hemingway. You?
Shatner. I'd fight William Shatner.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, William Shatner, has played two iconic television roles decades apart. In the 1960s, he was Captain James T. Kirk in NBC's Star Trek. More recently, he starred as unpredictable attorney Denny Crane in ABC's Boston Legal. And at the age of 80, he's still performing. He's recorded and released a 2-CD concept album called Seeking Major Tom, and currently he's starring in an autobiographical one-man stage show called Shatner's World, We just live in it. The show just concluded a limited Broadway run and is beginning a nationwide tour. William Shatner was born in Montreal, studied economics at McGill University, and performed at the Shakespearean Stratford Festival of Canada before embarking on a stage and screen career in the U.S. William Shatner, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be at Fresh Air.
The night that I saw your play, the most memorable thing to me, the most touching thing, wasn't even words. It was you folding a jacket and the way, the preciseness with which you folded it and why. Can you talk about that?
Well, my father was in the clothing business, and he once showed me how to fold a jacket for shipping. The whole idea was I was the only son. I was going to go into the family business. So my father showed me how to fold a jacket, and I remembered that because he folded it with such care. It was like a sculptor putting the last touches on his sculpturing, sanding that last moment. And it became, in my mind's eye for years, a part of my father. So when I thought of telling the story of my father's death, it came to me that I would tell it through the act of his jacket, and how, so I take my jacket off, and it becomes part of my father, and then I lay it to rest in a coffin, and then I bury it. And then the most moving moment for me is that I come to the conclusion that life doesn't have to end with death if love is present, and I put the jacket back on.
There's no way of getting around an interview with you when we're talking about your whole career without getting to your most iconic role of James T. Kirk in Star Trek.
But, that's cool.
But I thought that we would start by playing a clip. I found something where you're giving a little speech, so it shows that the way you act as James T. Kirk, but it talks about a philosophy that sounds not too far removed from the one that you talk about in your new Broadway show. So here's a scene in which Captain James T. Kirk is encouraging his team to see that the advantages of a starship trump its risks.
Do you wish that the first Apollo mission hadn't reached the moon, or that we hadn't gone on to Mars and then to the nearest star? That's like saying you wish that you still operated with scalpels and sewed your patients up with catgut, like your great-great-great-great-grandfather used to. I'm in command. I could order this. But I'm not. Because Dr. McCoy is right in pointing out the enormous danger potential in any contact with life and intelligence as fantastically advanced as this. But I must point out that the possibilities, the potential for knowledge and advancement is equally great. Risk. Risk is our business. That's what this starship is all about. That's why we're aboard her.
That's our guest, William Shatner, in his iconic role as Starship Captain James T. Kirk in the 1960s TV series Star Trek.
God, 50 years ago, unbelievable.
Almost. So, well, you say in your Broadway show that it's easy to say no, it's risky to say yes. Does that speak to you through the world of Star Trek that long ago?
Are you speaking
to you?
Yes. It's easy to say no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not leaving the house. I'm happy with what I got. No, I'm not going there. No, I don't want a new idea. The old idea is fine. No. And you're safe. You're right in your little hole. You haven't moved. And what you did before is what you're doing now, and that's safe. That's comforting. You're going to die that way. No, and you put in your hole, and that's fine. Good. And you're dead. Yes requires you to move out of that hole. Yes is like those little animals that pop their head out, look around. What's going on? I'm back in my hole. But some of them don't go. Some of them, what is that wonderful series where these little
The meerkats?
Animals,
Meerkat Manor.
Yeah, there you go. It's a meerkat. You want to be a meerkat. They're saying yes to risk. Taking risk is the way we should lead our life.
I guess it was 1976 when Saturday Night Live, in its first season, did a long spoof of Star Trek. And the audience that night reacted with such love and familiarity to John Belushi as you that it was clear that something was up. Of all the imitators of Captain Kirk, do you have one that's closest to your heart? Or farthest away?
No, I always thought I did the best imitation, but geez, nobody. I tell you, the iconic moment, I was the host of Saturday Night Live. And they've never asked me back, by the way, in all these years. And it was I, as Shatner, come up in front of all these geeks who are wearing ears. And I call them geeks now, then. But I've done a documentary in which I portray them mm-hmm. as they really are. They're not geeks. They're people in search of something else, but that's another whole subject. Anyway, a group of these SNL people were wearing ears and all that. And I gave the phrase, get a life. And a lot of the people laughed, and some of the people didn't laugh, but it was meant in fun, and I ultimately wrote a book called Get a Life, which examined why the people are going to conventions.
Well, I consider it one of the – I don't mean to stop you. I just consider it one of the best moments ever on Saturday Night Live. And I want to ask you a couple of questions about it, but first, let's play it.
You know, before I answer any more questions, there's something I wanted to say. Having received all your letters over the years, and I've spoken to many of you, and some of you have traveled, you know, hundreds of miles to be here, I'd just like to say, get a life, will you, people? I mean, for crying out loud, it's just a TV show. I mean, look at you. Look at the way you're dressed. You've turned an enjoyable little job that I did as a lark for a few years into a colossal waste of time. I mean, how old are you people? What have you done with yourselves? You must be almost 30. Have you ever kissed a girl? I didn't think so. There's a whole world out there. When I was your age, I didn't watch television. I live. So move out of your parents' basement. And get your own apartments and grow the hell up. I mean, it's just a TV show, damn it. It's just a TV show.
That's William Shatner in a sketch from a 1986 edition of Saturday Night Live. In your one-man show, you show a clip from one of your documentaries in which you're talking to Patrick Stewart, who played Jean-Luc Picard from Star Trek The Next Generation. And he talks about realizing that his obituary will lead with Star Trek, and he says he's fine with that. And then you say at that moment that you had an epiphany. Will you say that to us now?
I had an epiphany.
Now, would you explain the
you
epiphany?
Oh, you want an explanation.
I know. Oh, man.
I had spent years doing Star Trek bits and things, and a lot of people loved it. A lot of people mocked it. A lot of people, you know, they did their various comic turns on Star Trek. And I went with the joke because you're not going to go with the joke. At the time, the 3 years I spent, I applied every talent I had to making it valid and working on story and doing the best I could. There were many, many talents who did that. I don't mean to take that away. All I'm saying is I did the best I could. So when I left Star Trek, I left it with pride and went on to other things. And then Star Trek started to become popular about 6 years afterwards as it went into syndication. And then people started talking about, hey, beam me up, Scotty, and there's Captain Kirk. And somebody would say, do you really go where no man has gone before? and that sort of semi-mocking tone that I thought, well, all right, maybe it wasn't as good as I thought it was, and maybe I wasn't as good as I thought it was, and I held myself up defensively. It was only watching Patrick Stewart and the gravitas that this great Shakespearean actor gave to his role that I suddenly realized that this guy is taking Captain Picard every bit as seriously as Macbeth. And I used to. And I stopped. And what the hell's the matter with me? It was a great piece of work. Everybody contributed to 3 years that has lasted 50. It's a phenomena. Mm-hmm. Why aren't I proud of it? And that's when I had that moment.
You did manage to create a second major TV character, which a lot of iconic actors do not on television. But Denny Crane on ABC's The Practice and Boston Legal is just about every bit as big. And on the night that I saw your Broadway show, got as much applause for the first mention of Denny Crane as for the first mention of James T. Kirk. Now, I have such respect for David E. Kelly as a TV writer-producer.
He's a genius.
It's just such a funny character. And I'm wondering, how quickly did you and Kelly find each other's wavelengths? I mean, because I think producers, once they see what an actor can do, start writing more for them.
Well, you see, that's very astute of you. That's exactly what happened. He had me saying Denny Crane. I thought, well, why is this guy saying Denny Crane all the time? I mean, it was a good comic device. I don't know what David had in mind. But every so often, he would say, Denny Crane. And in my mind, what I saw was a lizard who sticks his tongue out. Okay, it's funny on the surface, right? Denny Crane. But wait a minute. Why does the lizard stick his tongue out? Do you know why? Because that's the way it's listening and looking and tasting its environment. Its tongue is its, I don't know about eyes, but it's his whiskers. It's its means of appreciating what's in front of it. It sticks its tongue out to be sure that it's not going to be eaten. It's identifying itself by sticking its tongue out. And so I thought, that's what he's doing. He's saying, Denny Crane, to see what the... I mean, he used to be a great lawyer. So when he says Denny Crane, who's appreciating that? I began to think of Denny Crane. He sticks his tongue out. So he had me in one scene, David Kelly wrote, Denny Crane, 7 over 8 times. How do you play that? I played it like the lizard saying, Denny Crane. Okay, what was the reaction on that? Well, Denny Crane. Denny Crane. He tries a different series of ways of sticking his tongue out by saying Denny Crane to see who's there to, and nobody pays any attention to him. He's trying to say, here I am, but without being able to say it. And that was the image I had.
I'd like to play a scene from Boston Legal. This is from 2006 with you in the courtroom as Denny Crane. And it shows your outrageousness and your – it shows a lot about your character in a very brief scene. It's a case in which an attractive young woman is seeking emancipation from her parents and trying to make it as a young model. And your cross-examination hones in immediately on her daily diet.
What'd you have for breakfast this morning?
I had a diet soda and a cracker with some butter spray on it.
And lunch?
I didn't eat lunch. I can't eat when I'm stressed out.
So how many calories have you had today?
16.
Are you aware that the daily required number of calories for someone your age and height is somewhere between 18 and 2400?
And are you aware that 2 out of 3 Americans are overweight? No one's calling them sick. I'm healthy. I watch what I eat and I exercise. You can ask any fat girl at my school if she'd want to trade places with me.
No, don't go knocking fat girls. I love chubby sex. I'm sure your honor does.
Mr. Crane.
Ms. Wilson, are you aware the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders defines anorexia nervosa as a mental illness?
30 years ago, they said the same thing about homosexuality.
Exactly. No further questions?
That's great. Great writing.
That's
great
our guest, writing. William Shatner, is attorney Denny Crane in the David E. Kelly series, Boston Legal. My further question is, how much fun was this guy to play?
Oh, my Lord. I could do anything. I remember one moment he was giving himself Botox injections, himself, and something surprised him. So he sprang out of his chair and had a Botox needle sticking out of his forehead. I mean, he takes a gun into the office and he shoots somebody because, the things that Kelly imagined were so outrageous and so plausible in an outrageous character, because in one moment he's totally lucid and the other he's totally insane. How extraordinary. What a character to play. And it was a sad, sad moment to say goodbye when the show was over.
Your one-man show tour for Shatner's World, We Just Live in It, I'm looking at the schedule. It's March 10th, L.A., March 11th, San Francisco, March 13th, Philadelphia, March 15th, Minneapolis. I mean, that's a grueling young rock star schedule. How and why are you doing it that way?
How am I going to do it? How am I going to do it? I'm going to do it. I once did, as a much younger man, 43 cities in 44 days. I came back to Los Angeles, and as I came down the escalator to get the baggage, my hand was trembling. And I thought, wow, that was challenging physically. I can do this. My wife's going to be with me. I'll make it by resting as much as possible. And if nothing else in my life, I point to my endurance. I used to run a track, and I was an endurance runner. And I'm doing everything I can to make this work, because at the end of which, like I did on opening night, I became exultant. I did it. And I will be there at your city, and I will make it a great show, and fear not.
I noticed that you're scheduled to perform in Dallas, Texas on March 22nd.
Yes.
That's the day you turn 81 years old. Any special plans?
I am. Plans? To stagger on stage and give the best performance of my life.
Well, congratulations on the show, the tour, the longevity, the career, and thank you for being on Fresh Air. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you. So have I, and I fully expect it to, and it's met my expectations.
William Shatner is on the road through April 19th with his one-man show, Shatner's World. We just live in it. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Kirk, you're still alive, my old friend.
Still old friend. You've managed to kill just about everyone else, but like a poor marksman, you keep missing the target.
I shall leave you as you left me.
Marooned for all eternity in the center of a dead planet. Buried alive. Buried alive.